Sophomore year, I got involved in the divestment campaign. It had started as something of a lark, I suppose, part of the radical pose my friends and I sought to maintain, a subconscious end run around issues closer to home. But as the months passed, and I found myself drawn into a larger role, I noticed that people had begun to listen to my opinions. It was a discovery that made me hungry for words. Not words to hide behind, but words that could carry a message, support an idea. When we started planning the rally for the trustees meeting, and somebody suggested that I open the thing, I quickly agreed. I figured I was ready, and could reach people where it counted. I thought my voice wouldn't fail me. The agenda had been carefully arranged beforehand. I was only supposed to make a few opening remarks, in the middle of which a couple of white students would come on stage dressed in their paramilitary uniforms to drag me away. A bit of street theater, a way to dramatize the situation for activists in South Africa. I knew the score, I had helped plan the script. Only when I sat down to prepare a few notes for what I might say, something had happened. In my mind, it somehow became more than just a 2-minute speech, more than a way to prove my political orthodoxy. I started to remember my father's visit to Miss Hefty's class, the power of my father's words to transform. If I could just find the right words, I had thought to myself. With the right words, everything could change. South Africa, the lives of ghetto kids just a few miles away, my own tenuous place in the world. I was still in that trance-like state when I mounted the stage. For I don't know how long, I just stood there, the sun in my eyes, the crowd of a few hundred restless after lunch. A couple of students were throwing a frisbee on the lawn. Others were standing off to the side, ready to break off to the library at any moment. Without waiting for a cue, I stepped up to the microphone. "There's a struggle going on," I said. My voice barely carried beyond the first few rows. A few people looked up, and I waited for the crowd to quiet. "I say there's a struggle going on." The frisbee players stopped. "It's happening an ocean away, but it's a struggle that touches each and every one of us, whether we know it or not, whether we want it or not. A struggle that demands we choose sides, not between black and white, not between rich and poor. No, it's a harder choice than that. It's a choice between dignity and servitude, between fairness and injustice, between commitment and indifference, a choice between right and wrong." I stopped. The crowd was quiet now, watching me. Somebody started to clap. "Go on with it, Barack," somebody else shouted. "Tell it like it is." Then the others started in, clapping, cheering, and I knew I had them, that the connection had been made. I took hold of the mic, ready to plunge on, when I felt someone's hands grabbing me from behind. It was just as we had planned it, Andy and Jonathan looking grim-faced behind their dark glasses. They started yanking me off the stage, and I was supposed to act like I was trying to break free, except a part of me wasn't acting. I really wanted to stay up there, to hear my voice bouncing off the crowd and returning back to me in applause. I had so much left to say. My friendships with Regina, and others like her, would lead me to re-examine the choices I made. "Look at yourself before you pass judgment," they would tell me. "Don't make someone else clean up your mess," they would say. "It's not about you," I'd be reminded. They were simple points, homilies I had heard 1,000 times before, in all their variations, from TV sitcoms and philosophy books, from my grandparents and from my mother. I had stopped listening at a certain point, I now realized, so wrapped up had I been in my own perceived injuries, so eager was I to escape the imagined traps that white authority had set for me. To that white world, I had been willing to cede the values of my childhood, as if those values were somehow irreversibly soiled by the endless falsehoods that whites spoke about black. Except now I was hearing the same thing from black people I respected, people with more excuses for bitterness than I might ever claim for myself. "Who told you that being honest was a white thing?" they asked me. "Who sold you this bill of goods that your situation exempted you from being thoughtful or diligent or kind, or that morality had a color? You've lost your way, brother. Your ideas about yourself, about who you are and who you might become, have grown stunted and narrow and small." I came to realize that while my identity might begin with the fact of my race, it didn't, couldn't end there. At least that's what I would choose to believe. When I heard about a transfer program that Occidental had arranged with Columbia University, I'd been quick to apply. I figured that if there weren't any more black students at Columbia than there were at Oxy, I'd be at least in the heart of a true city, with black neighborhoods in close proximity. As it was, there wasn't much in L.A. to hold me back. Most of my friends were graduating that year. With the Wall Street boom, Manhattan was humming, new developments cropping up everywhere, men and women barely out of their 20s already enjoying ridiculous wealth, the fashion merchants fast on their heels. The beauty, the filth, the noise, and the excess, all of it dazzled my senses. There seemed no constraints on the originality of lifestyles or the manufacture of desire. A more expensive restaurant, a finer suit of clothes, a more exclusive night spot, a more beautiful woman, a more potent high. Uncertain of my ability to steer a course of moderation, fearful of falling into old habits, I took on the temperament, if not the convictions, of a street corner preacher, prepared to see temptation everywhere, ready to overrun a fragile will. My reaction was more than just an attempt to curb an excessive appetite, though, or a response to sensory overload. Beneath the hum, the motion, I was seeing the steady fracturing of the world taking place. I had seen worse poverty in Indonesia and glimpsed the violent mood of inner-city kids in L.A. I had grown accustomed everywhere to suspicion between the races. But whether because of New York's density or because of its scale, it was only now that I began to grasp the almost mathematical precision with which America's race and class problems joined, the depth, the ferocity of resulting tribal wars, the bile that flowed freely not just out on the streets but in the stalls of Columbia's bathrooms as well, where no matter how many times the administration tried to paint over them, the walls remained scratched with blunt correspondence between niggers and kikes. It was as if all middle ground had collapsed, utterly. And nowhere, it seemed, was that collapse more apparent than in the black community I had so lovingly imagined and within which I had hoped to find refuge. I might meet a black friend at his Midtown law firm, and before heading to lunch at the MoMA, I would look out across the city toward the East River from his high-rise office, imagining a satisfactory life for myself, a vocation, a family, a home, until I noticed that the only other blacks in the office were messengers or clerks, the only other blacks in the museum, the blue-jacketed security guards who counted the hours before they could catch their trains home to Brooklyn or Queens. I might wander through Harlem to play on courts I'd once read about, or to hear Jesse Jackson make a speech on 125th, or, on a rare Sunday morning, to sit in the back pews of Abyssinian Baptist Church, lifted by the gospel choir's sweet, sorrowful song, and catch a fleeting glimpse of that thing which I sought. But I had no guide that might show me how to join this troubled world, and when I looked for an apartment there, I found Sugar Hill's elegant brownstones occupied and out of reach, the few decent rental buildings with 10-year-long waiting lists, so that all that remained were the rows and rows of uninhabitable tenements, in front of which young men counted out their rolls of large bills, and winos slouched and stumbled and wept softly to themselves. I took all this as a personal affront, a mockery of my tender ambitions, although when I brought up the subject with people who had lived in New York for a while, I was told there was nothing original about my observations. The city was out of control, they said, the polarization a natural phenomenon, like monsoons or continental drift. Political discussions, the kind that at Occidental had once seemed so intense and purposeful, came to take on the flavor of the socialist conferences I sometimes attended at Cooper Union, or the African cultural fairs that took place in Harlem and Brooklyn during the summers, a few of the many diversions New York had to offer, like going to a foreign film or ice skating at Rockefeller Center. With a bit of money, I was free to live like most middle-class blacks in Manhattan, free to choose a motif around which to organize my life, free to patch together a collage of styles, friends, watering holes, political affiliations. I sensed, though, that at some stage, maybe when you had children and decided you could stay in the city only at the cost of a private school, or when you began taking cabs at night to avoid the subways, or when you decided that you needed a doorman in your apartment building, your choice was irrevocable, the divide was now impassable, and you would find yourself on the side of the line that you'd never intended to be on. Unwilling to make that choice, I spent a year walking from one end of Manhattan to the other. Like a tourist, I watched the range of human possibility on display, trying to trace out my future in the lives of the people I saw, looking for some opening through which I could re-enter. It was in this humorless mood that my mother and sister found me when they came to visit during my first summer in New York. "He's so skinny," Maya said to my mother. "He only has 2 towels, my mother shouted as she inspected the bathroom. "And 3 plates." They both began to giggle. That summer, I had found a job clearing a construction site on the Upper West Side, so my mother and sister spent most of their days exploring the city on their own. When we met for dinner, they would give me a detailed report of their adventures, eating strawberries and cream at the plaza, taking the ferry to the Statue of Liberty, visiting the Cezannes at the Met. I would eat in silence until they were finished and then begin a long discourse on the problems of the city and the politics of the dispossessed. I scolded Maya for spending one evening watching TV instead of reading the novels I had bought for her. I instructed my mother on the various ways that foreign donors and international development organizations like the one she was working for bred dependence in the Third World. When the two of them withdrew to the kitchen, I would overhear Maya complaining to my mother. "Barry's okay, isn't he? I mean, I hope he doesn't lose his cool and become one of those freaks you see on the street around here." One evening, I was thumbing through the Village Voice, and my mother's eyes lit on an advertisement for a movie, Black Orpheus, that was showing downtown. She insisted that we go see it that night. She said that it was the first foreign film she had ever seen. "I was only 16 then," she told us as we entered the elevator. "I'd just been accepted to the University of Chicago. Gramps hadn't told me yet that he wouldn't let me go, and I was there for the summer, working as an au pair. It was the first time I'd ever really been on my own. Gosh, I felt like such an adult. And when I saw this film, I thought it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen." We took a cab to the Revival Theater where the movie was playing. The film, a groundbreaker of sorts due to its mostly black Brazilian cast, had been made in the 50s. The storyline was simple. The myth of the ill-fated lovers Orpheus and Eurydice, set in the favelas of Rio during Carnival. In technicolor splendor, set against scenic green hills, the black and brown Brazilians sang and danced and strummed guitars, like carefree birds in colorful plumage. About halfway through the movie, I decided I'd seen enough and turned to my mother to see if she might be ready to go. But her face, lit by the blue glow of the screen, was set in a wistful gaze. At that moment, I felt as if I were being given a window into her heart, the unreflective heart of her youth. I suddenly realized that the depiction of childlike blacks I was now seeing on the screen, the reverse image of Conrad's dark savages, was what my mother had carried with her to Hawaii all those years before, a reflection of the simple fantasies that had been forbidden to a white middle-class girl from Kansas, the promise of another life, warm, sensual, exotic, different. I turned away, embarrassed for her, irritated with the people around me. Sitting there in the dark, I was reminded of a conversation I'd had a few years earlier with a friend of my mother's, an Englishman who had worked for an international aid organization throughout Africa and Asia. He had told me that of all the different peoples he had met in his travels, the Dik of Sudan were the strangest. "Usually, after a month or two, you make contact," he had said. "Even where you don't speak the language, there's a smile or a joke, you know, some semblance of recognition. But at the end of a year with the Dik, they remained utterly alien to me. They laughed at the things that drove me to despair. What I thought was funny seemed to leave them stone cold." I'd spared him the information that the Dik were Nilots, distant cousins of mine. I'd tried to imagine this pale Englishman on a parched desert somewhere, his back turned away from a circle of naked tribesmen, his eyes searching an empty sky, bitter in his solitude. And the same thought had occurred to me then that I carried with me now as I left the movie theater with my mother and sister. The emotions between the races could never be pure. Even love was tarnished by the desire to find in the other some element that was missing in ourselves. Whether we sought out our demons or our salvation, the other race would always remain just that, menacing, alien, and apart. "Kind of corny, huh?" Maya said as my mother went to the bathroom. "What?" "The movie. It was kind of corny. Just Mom's style." For the next several days, I tried to avoid situations where my mother and I might be forced to talk. Then, a few days before they were about to leave, my mother noticed a letter addressed to my father in my hand. I asked her if she had an international postage stamp. "You guys arranging for a visit?" she asked. I told her briefly of plans to visit Kenya. "Well, I think it would be wonderful for you two to finally get to know each other," she said. "It was probably a bit tough for a 10-year-old to take, but now that you're older..." I shrugged. "Who knows," I said. "I hope you don't feel resentful towards him. Why would I? I don't know. We sat there for a while, and then, without any prompting, my mother began to retell an old story, in a distant voice, as if she were telling it to herself. It wasn't your father's fault that he left, you know. I divorced him. When the two of us got married, your grandparents weren't happy with the idea, but they said okay. They probably couldn't have stopped us anyway, and they eventually came around to the idea that it was the right thing to do. Then Barack's father, your grandfather, Hussein, wrote Gramps this long, nasty letter saying he didn't approve of the marriage. He didn't want the Obama blood sullied by a white woman, he said. Well, you can imagine how Gramps reacted to that. And then there was a problem with your father's first wife. He had told me they were separated, but it was a village wedding, so there were no legal documents that could show a divorce. My mother's chin began to tremble, and she bit down on her lip, steadying herself. She said, "Your father wrote back saying he was going to go ahead with it. Then you were born, and we agreed that the three of us would return to Kenya after he finished his studies. But your grandfather Hussein was still writing to your father, threatening to have his student visa revoked." By this time, Toot had become hysterical. She had read about the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya a few years earlier, which the Western press really played up, and she was sure that I would have my head chopped off and you would be taken away. Even then, it might have worked out. When your father graduated from University of Hawaii, he received two scholarship offers. One was to the New School here in New York. The other one was to Harvard. The New School agreed to pay for everything, room and board, a job on campus, enough to support all three of us. Harvard just agreed to pay tuition. But Barack was such a stubborn bastard, he had to go to Harvard. "How can I refuse the best education?" he told me. That's all he could think about, proving he was the best. My mother sighed, running her hands through her hair. Later, when he came to visit us in Hawaii that time, he wanted us to come live with him. But I was still married to Lolo then, and his third wife had just left him. And I just didn't think. She stopped and laughed to herself. "Did I ever tell you that he was late for our first date? He asked me to meet him in front of the university library at 1. When I got there, he hadn't arrived, but I figured I'd give him a few minutes. It was a nice day, so I laid out on one of the benches, and before I knew it, I had fallen asleep. Well, an hour later, he shows up with a couple of his friends. I woke up, and the three of them were standing over me, and I heard your father saying, serious as he can be, 'You see, gentlemen, I told you that she was a fine girl and that she would wait for me.' My mother laughed once more, and once again I saw her as the child she had been. In her smiling, slightly puzzled face, I saw what all children must see at some point if they are to grow up. Their parents' lives revealed to them as separate and apart, reaching out beyond the point of their union or the birth of a child. Lives unfurling back to grandparents, great-grandparents, an infinite number of chance meetings, misunderstandings, projected hopes, limited circumstances. My mother was that girl, with the movie of beautiful black people in her head, flattered by my father's attention, confused and alone, trying to break out of the grip of her own parents' lives. The innocence she carried that day, waiting for my father, had been tinged with misconceptions, her own needs. But it was a guileless need, one without self-consciousness. And perhaps that's how any love begins. Impulses and cloudy images that allow us to break across our solitude, and then, if we're lucky, are finally transformed into something firmer. What I heard from my mother that day, speaking about my father, was something that I suspect most Americans will never hear from the lips of those of another race, and so cannot be expected to believe might exist between black and white. The love of someone who knows your life in the round, a love that will survive disappointment. She saw my father as everyone hopes at least one other person might see him. She had tried to help the child who never knew him see him in the same way. And it was the look on her face that day that I would remember, when a few months later I called to tell her that my father had died, and heard her cry out over the distance. In 1983, I decided to become a community organizer. There wasn't much detail to the idea. I didn't know anyone making a living that way. When classmates in college asked me just what it was that a community organizer did, I couldn't answer them directly. Instead, I'd pronounce on the need for change. Change won't come from the top, I would say. Change will come from a mobilized grassroots. That's what I'll do. I'll organize black folks at the grassroots for change. And my friends, black and white, would heartily commend me for my ideals before heading toward the post office to mail in their graduate school applications. I couldn't really blame them for being skeptical. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, I can construct a certain logic to my decision, show how becoming an organizer was part of that larger narrative, starting with my father and his father before him, my mother and her parents, my memories of Indonesia, with its beggars and farmers and the loss of Lolo to power, on through Ray and Regina, and my move to New York, my father's death. I can see that my choices were never truly mine alone, and that that is how it should be, that to assert otherwise is to chase after a sorry sort of freedom. But such recognition only came later. At the time, about to graduate from college, I was operating mainly on impulse, like a salmon swimming blindly upstream toward the site of his own conception. In classes and seminars, I would dress up these impulses in the slogans and theories that I'd discovered in books, thinking, falsely, that the slogans meant something, that they somehow made what I felt more amenable to proof. But at night, lying in bed, I would let the slogans drift away, to be replaced with a series of images, romantic images, of a past I had never known. They were of the civil rights movement, mostly, the grainy black-and-white footage that appears every February during Black History Month, the same images that my mother had offered me as a child. A pair of college students, hair short, back straight, placing their orders at a lunch counter teetering on the edge of riot. SNCC workers standing on a porch in some Mississippi backwater, trying to convince a family of sharecroppers to register to vote. A county jail bursting with children, their hands clasped together, singing freedom songs. Such images became a form of prayer for me, bolstering my spirits, channeling my emotions in a way that words never could. They told me, although even this much understanding may have come later, is also a construct, containing its own falsehoods, that I wasn't alone in my particular struggles, and that communities had never been a given in this country, at least not for blacks. Communities had to be created, fought for, tended like gardens. They expanded or contracted with the dreams of men, and in the civil rights movement, those dreams had been large. In the sit-ins, the marches, the jailhouse songs, I saw the African-American community becoming more than just the place where you had been born or the house where you'd been raised. Through organizing, through shared sacrifice, membership had been earned. And because membership was earned, because this community I imagined was still in the making, built on the promise that the larger American community, black, white, and brown, could somehow redefine itself, I believed that it might, over time, admit the uniqueness of my own life. That was my idea of organizing. It was a promise of redemption. And so, in the months leading up to graduation, I wrote to every civil rights organization I could think of, to any black elected official in the country with a progressive agenda, to neighborhood councils and tenant rights groups. When no one wrote back, I wasn't discouraged. I decided to find more conventional work for a year, to pay off my student loans, and maybe even save a little bit. Eventually, a consulting house to a multinational corporation agreed to hire me as a research assistant. Like a spy behind enemy lines, I arrived every day at my mid-Manhattan office and sat at my computer terminal, checking the Reuters machine that blinked bright emerald messages from across the globe. As far as I could tell, I was the only black man in the company, a source of shame for me, but a source of considerable pride for the company's secretarial pool. One day, as I sat down at my computer to write an article on interest rates, something unexpected happened. Alma called. I had never met this half-sister. We had written only intermittently. I knew that she had left Kenya to study in Germany, and in our letters we had mentioned the possibility of my going there for a visit, or perhaps her coming to the States. But the plans had always been left vague. Neither of us had any money, we would say. Maybe next year. Our correspondence maintained a cordial distance. Now, suddenly, I heard her voice for the first time. It was soft and dark, tinged with a colonial accent. For a few moments I couldn't understand the words, only the sound, a sound that seemed to have always been there, misplaced but not forgotten. She was coming to the States, she said, on a trip with several friends. Could she come to see me in New York? Of course, I said. You can stay with me. I can't wait. And she laughed, and I laughed, and then the line grew quiet with static and the sound of her breath. Well, she said, I can't stay on the phone too long. It's so expensive. Here's the flight information. And we hung up quickly after that, as if our contact was a treat to be doled out in small measures. 2 days before she was scheduled to arrive, Aoma called again, the voice thicker now, barely a whisper. I can't come after all, she said. One of our brothers, David, he's been killed in a motorcycle accident. I don't know any more than that. She began to cry. Oh, Barak, why do these things happen to us? I tried to comfort her as best I could. I asked her if I could do anything for her. I told her there would be other times for us to see each other. Eventually, her voice quieted. She had to go book a flight home to Kenya, she said. Okay then, Barak. See you. Bye. After she hung up, I left my office telling my secretary I'd be gone for the day. For hours, I wandered the streets of Manhattan, the sound of Alma's voice playing over and over in my mind. A continent away, a woman cries. On a dark, dusty road, a boy skids out of control, tumbling against hard earth, wheels spinning to silence. Who were these people, I asked myself, these strangers who carried my blood? What might save this woman from her sorrow? What wild, unspoken dreams had this boy possessed? Who was I, who shed no tears at the loss of his own? I still wonder sometimes how that first contact with Alma altered my life. Maybe by this time I was already committed to organizing, and Alma's voice simply served to remind me that I still had wounds to heal and could not heal myself. Or maybe, if our brother David hadn't died when he did, and Alma had come to New York as originally planned, and I had learned from her then what I would only learn later, about Kenya and about our father, maybe it would have relieved certain pressures that had built up inside me, showing me a different idea of community, allowing my ambitions to travel a narrower, more personal course, so that in the end I might have given myself over to stocks and bonds and the pull of respectability. I don't know. What is certain is that a few months after Alma's call, I turned in my resignation at the consulting firm and began looking in earnest for an organizing job. Once again, most of my letters went unanswered, and after 6 months I was broke, unemployed, eating soup from a can. I had all but given up on organizing when I received a call from a guy named Marty Kaufman. He explained that he'd started an organizing project in Chicago and was looking to hire a trainee. When he came to meet me in New York, his appearance didn't inspire much confidence. He was a white man of medium height, wearing a rumpled suit over a pudgy frame. His face was heavy with two-day-old whiskers. Behind a pair of thick, wire-rimmed glasses, his eyes seemed set in a perpetual squint. But he was smart and committed to his work. Marty had started organizing in the 60s with the student protests and ended up staying with it for 15 years. Farmers in Nebraska, blacks in Philadelphia, Mexicans in Chicago. Now he was trying to pull urban blacks and suburban whites together around a plan to save manufacturing jobs in metropolitan Chicago. He needed somebody to work with him, he said. Somebody black. Most of our work is with churches, he said. If poor and working class people want to build real power, they have to have some sort of institutional base. With the unions in the shape they're in, the churches are the only game in town. That's where the people are, and that's where the values are, even if they've been buried under a lot of bullshit. Churches won't work with you, though, just out of the goodness of their hearts. They'll talk a good game, a sermon on Sunday maybe, or a special offering for the homeless. But if push comes to shove, they won't really move unless you can show them how it'll help them pay their heating bill. Marty poured himself more hot water. What do you know about Chicago, anyway? I thought for a moment. Hog butcher to the world? I said finally. Marty shook his head. The butchery's closed a while ago. The Cubs never win, I offered. True. America's most segregated city, I said. A black man, Harold Washington, was just elected mayor, and white people don't like it. So you've been following Harold's career, Marty said. I'm surprised you haven't gone to work for him. I tried, I said. His office didn't write back. Marty smiled and took off his glasses, cleaning them with the end of his tie. Well, that's the thing to do, isn't it? He said. If you're young and black and interested in social issues, find a political campaign to work for, a powerful patron, somebody who can help you with your own career. And Harold's powerful, no doubt about it. Lots of charisma. He has almost monolithic support in the black community. About half the Hispanics, a handful of white liberals. You're right about one thing, though. The whole atmosphere in the city is polarized. A big media circus. Not much is getting done. And whose fault is that? I said. Marty put his glasses back on and met my stare. It's not a question of fault, Marty said. It's a question of whether any politician, even somebody with Harold's talent, can do much to break the cycle. A polarized city isn't necessarily a bad thing for a politician, black or white. Marty offered to start me off at $10,000 the first year, with a $2,000 travel allowance to buy a car. The salary would go up if things worked out. A week later, I loaded up my car and drove to Chicago. I arrived in Chicago in July, and the sun sparkled through the deep green trees. The boats were out of their moorings, their distant sails like the wings of doves across Lake Michigan. Marty had told me that he would be busy those first few days, and so I was left on my own. I had bought a map, and I followed Martin Luther King Drive from its northernmost to its southernmost point, then went back up Cottage Grove, down byways and alleys, past the apartment buildings and vacant lots, convenience stores and bungalow homes. And as I drove, I remembered. I remembered the whistle of the Illinois Central, bearing the weight of the thousands who had come up from the South so many years before, the black men and women and children, dirty from the soot of the rail cars, clutching their makeshift luggage, all making their way to Canaan land. The mailman I saw was Richard Wright, delivering mail before his first book sold. The little girl with the glasses and pigtails was Regina, skipping rope. I made a chain between my life and the faces I saw, borrowing other people's memories. In this way, I tried to take possession of the city, make it my own. It was during such a drive that I passed Smitty's Barber Shop, a 15 by 30 foot storefront on the edge of Hyde Park, with four barber's chairs and a card table for Letitia, the part-time manicurist. The door was propped open when I walked in, the barbershop smells of hair cream and antiseptic mingling with the sound of men's laughter and the hum of slow fans. Smitty turned out to be an older black man, gray-haired, slender and stooped. His chair was open, and so I took a seat, soon joining in the familiar barbershop banter of sports and women and yesterday's headlines, conversation at once intimate and anonymous, among men who've agreed to leave their troubles outside. Somebody had just finished telling a story about his neighbor. The man had been caught in bed, with his wife's cousin, and chased at the point of a kitchen knife, buck naked, out into the street, when the talk turned to politics. "Verdoliak and the rest of them cracker aldermen don't know when to quit," the man with the newspaper said, shaking his head in disgust. "When old man Daly was mayor, didn't nobody say nothing about him putting all them Irish up in City Hall. But the minute Harold tries to hire some black people, just to even things out, they call it reverse racism. Man, that's how it always is. Whenever a black man gets into power, they're going to try to change the rules on him. Worst part is, newspapers acting like it was black folks that started this whole mess. What you expect from the white man's paper? You right. Harold knows what he's doing, though. Just biding his time till the next election." That's how black people talked about Chicago's mayor, with a familiarity and affection normally reserved for a relative. His picture was everywhere, on the walls of shoe repair shops and beauty parlors, still glued to lampposts from the last campaign, even in the windows of the Korean dry cleaners in the Arab grocery stores, displayed prominently, like some protective totem. From the barbershop wall, that portrait looked down on me now, the handsome grizzled face, the bushy eyebrows and mustache, the twinkle in the eyes. Smitty noticed me looking at the picture and asked if I'd been in Chicago during the election. I told him I hadn't. He nodded his head. "Had to be there before Harold to understand what he means to this city," Smitty said. "Before Harold, seemed like we'd always be second-class citizens." "Plantation politics," the man with the newspaper said. "That's just what it was, too," Smitty said. "A plantation. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our souls for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with a vote." Clumps of hair fell into my lap as I listened to the men recall Harold's rise. He had run for mayor once before, shortly after the elder Daly died, but the candidacy had faltered, a source of shame, the men told me, the lack of unity within the black community, the doubts that had to be overcome. But Harold had tried again, and this time the people were ready. They had stuck with him when the press played up the income taxes he'd failed to pay. They'd rallied behind him when white Democratic committeemen, Verdoliak and others, announced their support for the Republican candidate, saying that the city would go to hell if it had a black mayor. They had turned out in record numbers on election night, ministers and gangbangers, young and old. And their faith had been rewarded. Smitty said, "That night Harold won, let me tell you, people just ran the streets. It was like the day Joe Lewis knocked out Schmeling. Same feeling. People weren't just proud of Harold, they were proud of themselves. I stayed inside, but my wife and I, we couldn't go to bed until 3, we were so excited. When I woke up the next morning, seemed like the most beautiful day of my life." Smitty's voice had fallen to a whisper, and everyone in the room began to smile. From a distance, reading the newspapers back in New York, I had shared in their pride, the same sort of pride that made me root for any pro football team that fielded a black quarterback. But something was different about what I was hearing now. There was a fervor in Smitty's voice that seemed to go beyond politics. "Had to be here to understand," he had said. He'd meant here in Chicago, but he could also have meant here in my shoes, an older black man who still burns from a lifetime of insults, of foiled ambitions, of ambitions abandoned before they'd been tried. I asked myself if I could truly understand that. I assumed, took for granted, that I could. Seeing me, these men had made the same assumption. Would they feel the same way if they knew more about me? I wondered. I tried to imagine what would happen if Gramps walked into the barber shop at that moment, how the talk would stop, how the spell would be broken, the different assumptions at work. Smitty handed me the mirror to check his handiwork, then pulled off my smock and brushed off the back of my shirt. "Thanks for the history lesson," I said, standing up. "Hey, that bar's free. Haircut's $10. What's your name, anyway?" "Barack." "Barack, huh? You a Muslim?" "My grandfather was." He took the money and shook my hand. "Well, Barack, you should come back a little sooner next time. Your hair was looking awful raggedy when you walked in." Late that afternoon, Marty picked me up in front of my new address and we headed south on the Skyway. After several miles, we took an exit leading into the southeast side, past rows of small houses made of gray clapboard or brick, until we arrived at a massive old factory that stretched out over several blocks. "The old Wisconsin steel plant," Marty announced. We sat there in silence, studying the building. It expressed some of the robust, brutal spirit of Chicago's industrial past. Metal beams and concrete rammed together, without much attention to comfort or detail. Only now it was empty and rust-stained, like an abandoned wreck. On the other side of the chain-link fence, a spotted, mangy cat ran through the weeds. "All kinds of people used to work in the plant," Marty said as he wheeled the car around and started back down the road. "Blacks, whites, Hispanics, all working the same jobs, all living the same kind of lives. But outside the plant, most of them didn't want anything to do with each other. And these are the church people I'm talking about. Brothers and sisters in Christ." We came to a stoplight, and I noticed a group of young white men in their undershirts, drinking beer on a stoop. A Verdoliak poster hung in one of the windows, and several of the men began to glare in my direction. I turned to Marty. "So what makes you think they can work together now?" "They don't have a choice," Marty said. "Not if they want their jobs back." As we re-entered the highway, Marty began to tell me more about the organization he'd built. The idea had first come to him 2 years earlier, he said, when he'd read reports of the plant closings and layoffs then sweeping across South Chicago and the southern suburbs. With the help of a sympathetic Catholic auxiliary bishop, he'd gone to meet with pastors and church members in the area and heard both blacks and whites talk about their shame of unemployment, their fear of losing a house or being cheated out of a pension, their common sense of having been betrayed. Eventually, over 20 churches had agreed to form an organization called Developing Communities Project, or DCP. Things hadn't moved quite as fast as Marty had hoped, the unions hadn't signed on, and the political war in the city council had proven to be a major distraction. Still, DCP had recently won its first significant victory, a $500,000 computerized job placement program that the Illinois legislature had agreed to fund. "We were on our way to a rally to celebrate this new job bank," Marty explained, "the opening shot in a long-term campaign. It's going to take a while to rebuild manufacturing out here, Marty said. 10 years minimum. But once we get the unions involved, we'll have a base to negotiate from. In the meantime, we just need to stop the hemorrhage and give people some short-term victories. Something to show people how much power they have once they stop fighting each other and start going after the real enemy. And who's that? I asked. Marty shrugged. The investment bankers, the politicians, the fat cat lobbyists. Marty nodded to himself, squinting at the road ahead. Looking at him, I began to suspect that he wasn't as cynical as he liked to make out, that the plant we just left carried a larger meaning for him. Somewhere in his life, I thought, he too had been betrayed. It was twilight by the time we crossed the city line and pulled into the parking lot of a large suburban school, where crowds of people were already making their way into the auditorium. They appeared as Marty had described them, laid-off steel workers, secretaries, and truck drivers, men and women who smoked a lot and didn't watch their weight, shopped at Sears or Kmart, drove late-model cars from Detroit, and ate at Red Lobster on special occasions. A barrel-chested black man in a cleric's collar greeted us at the door, and Marty introduced him as Deacon Wilbur Milton, co-president of the organization. "Welcome," Will said, pumping my hand. "We've been wondering when we'd actually get to meet you. Thought maybe Marty just made you up." Marty peeked inside the auditorium. "How's turnout looking?" "Good so far. Everybody seems to be making their quota. Governor's people just called to say he's on his way." Marty and Will began walking towards the stage, their heads buried in the evening's agenda. I started to follow them, but found my path blocked by three black women of indeterminate age. One of them, a pretty woman with orange-tinted hair, introduced herself as Angela, then leaned over to me and whispered, "You're Barack, aren't you?" I nodded. "You don't know how glad we are to see you." "You really don't," the older woman next to Angela said. I offered the woman my hand, and she smiled to show off a gold front tooth. "I'm sorry," she said, taking my hand. "I'm Shirley." She gestured towards the last woman, dark and heavy-set. "This is Mona. Don't he look clean-cut, Mona?" "Sure does," Mona said with a laugh. "Don't get me wrong," Angela said, her voice still lowered a pitch. "I've got nothing against Marty, but the fact is, there's only so far you can—" "Hey, Angela!" We looked up to see Marty waving at us from the stage. "You guys can talk to Barack all you want later. Right now, I need all of you up here with me." The auditorium was almost filled by this time, 2,000 people in all, maybe a third of them black, bust in from the city. A procession of speakers then mounted the stage, a black legislator and a white legislator, a Baptist minister and Cardinal Bernardine, and finally the governor, who offered his solemn pledge of support for the new job bank and recited evidence of his tireless efforts on behalf of the working men and women of Illinois. Seeing all these black and white faces together in one place, I found myself feeling cheered, recognizing in myself the same vision driving Marty, his confidence in the populist impulse and working-class solidarity, his faith that if you could just clear away the politicians and media and bureaucrats and give everybody a seat at the table, then ordinary people could find common ground. The day after the rally, Marty decided it was time for me to do some real work, and he handed me a long list of people to interview. "Find out their self-interest," he said. "That's why people become involved in organizing, because they think they'll get something out of it. Once I found an issue enough people cared about, I could take them into action. With enough actions, I could start to build power." I was worried at first about people's willingness to meet and talk with me, but after a few phone calls, I found that people didn't mind a chance to air their opinions about a do-nothing alderman or the neighbor who refused to mow his lawn. The more interviews I did, the more I began to hear certain recurring themes. I learned, for example, that most of the people in the area had been raised farther north, or on Chicago's west side, in the cramped black enclaves the restrictive covenants had created for most of the city's history. The people I talked to had some fond memories of that self-contained world, but they also remembered the absence of heat and light and space to breathe, that and the sight of their parents grinding out life in physical labor. A few had followed their parents into the steel mills or onto the assembly line, but many more had found jobs as mail carriers, bus drivers, teachers, and social workers, taking advantage of the more rigorous enforcement of anti-discrimination laws in the public sector. Such jobs had benefits and provided enough security to think about taking on a mortgage. With the passage of fair housing laws, they began to buy homes, one at a time, in Roseland and other white neighborhoods. Not because they were necessarily interested in mingling with whites, they insisted, but because the houses there were affordable, with small yards for their children, because the schools were better, and the store's cheaper, and maybe just because they could. Often, as I listened to these stories, I would find myself reminded of the stories that Gramps and Toot and my mother had told, stories of hardship and migration, the drive for something better. But there was an inescapable difference between what I was hearing now and what I remembered, as if the images of my childhood had been run in reverse. In these new stories, for sale signs cropped up like dandelions under a summer sun. Stones flew through windows, and the strained voices of anxious parents could be heard calling children indoors from innocent games. Entire blocks turned over in less than 6 months. Entire neighborhoods in less than 5 years. In these stories, wherever black and white met, the result was sure to be anger and grief. The area had never fully recovered from this racial upheaval. The stores and banks had left with their white customers, causing main thoroughfares to decompose. City services had declined. Still, when the blacks who now lived in their homes for 10 or 15 years looked back on the way things had turned out, they did so with some measure of satisfaction. On the strength of two incomes, they had paid off house notes and car notes, maybe college educations, for the sons or daughters whose graduation pictures filled every mantelpiece. They had kept their homes up and kept their children off the streets. They had formed block clubs to make sure that others did too. It was when they spoke of the future that a certain disquiet entered their voices. They would mention a cousin or sibling who came by every so often asking for money, or an adult child, unemployed, who still lived at home. Even the success of those children who'd made it through college and into the white-collar world harbored within it an element of loss. The better these children did, the more likely they were to move away. In their place, younger, less stable families moved in. The second wave of migrants from poorer neighborhoods, newcomers who couldn't always afford to keep up with their mortgage payments or invest in periodic maintenance. Car thefts were up. The leafy parks were empty. People began to spend more time inside. They invested in elaborate wrought iron doors. They wondered if they could afford to sell at a loss and retire to a warmer climate, perhaps move back to the South. So despite the deserved sense of accomplishment these men and women felt, despite the irrefutable evidence of their own progress, our conversations were marked by another, more ominous strain. The boarded-up homes, the decaying storefronts, the aging church rolls, kids from unknown families who swaggered down the streets, loud congregations of teenage boys, teenage girls feeding potato chips to crying toddlers, the discarded wrappers tumbling down the block, all of it whispered painful truths, told them the progress they'd found was ephemeral, rooted in thin soil, that it might not even last their lifetimes. And it was this dual sense of individual advancement and collective decline that I thought accounted for some of the most troubling attitudes I heard in some conversations. I heard it in the excessive pride some of the men took in their well-stocked bars they'd built in their basements, with the lava lamps and the mirrored walls, in the protective plastic that the women kept over their spotless carpets and sofas. In all of it, one saw a determined effort to shore up the belief that things had in fact changed, if only some people would start acting right. "I try to avoid driving through Rosen when I can," a woman from neighboring Washington Heights explained to me one evening. "People down there are just rougher. You can see it in the way they keep up their homes. You didn't see things like that when the white folks still lived there." Distinctions between neighborhoods, then blocks, then finally neighbors within a block. Attempts to cordon off, control the decay. One thing I noticed, though. The woman so concerned with the cruder habits of her neighbors had a picture of Harold in her kitchen, right next to the sampler of the 23rd Psalm. So did the young man who lived in the crumbling apartment a few blocks away and was trying to make ends meet by mixing records at dance parties. As it had for the men in Smitty's barbershop, the election had given both these people a new idea of themselves. Or maybe it was an old idea, born of a simpler time. Harold was something they held in common. Like my idea of organizing, he held out an offer of collective redemption. During a meeting with Ruby Stiles, a stocky woman who worked as an office manager on the north side of the city, we had been talking about her teenage son Kyle, a bright but diffident boy who was starting to have trouble at school, when she mentioned the rise in local gang activity. One of Kyle's friends had been shot just last week, she said, right in front of his house. The boy was all right, but now Ruby was worried about her own son's safety. Over the next few days, I had Ruby introduce me to other parents who shared her fears and felt frustrated over the lackluster police response. When I suggested that we invite the district commander to a neighborhood meeting so the community could air its concerns, everyone agreed. And as we talked about publicity, one of the women mentioned that there was a Baptist church on the block where the boy had been shot, and that a pastor there, a Reverend Reynolds, might be willing to make an announcement to his congregation. It took me a week of phone calls, but when I finally reached Reverend Reynolds, his response seemed promising. He was the president of the local ministerial alliance. He said that the group would be holding its regular meeting the very next day, and that he would be happy to put me on the agenda. I hung up the phone full of excitement and arrived at Reverend Reynolds' church early the next morning. We all sat around a long table, and Reverend Reynolds led us in prayer before offering me the floor. Suppressing my nerves, I told the ministers about the increasing gang activity and the meeting we had planned, and passed out flyers for them to distribute to their congregations. Just as I passed out the last flyers, a tall, pecan-colored man entered the room. He wore a blue, double-breasted suit and a large gold cross against his scarlet tie. His hair was straightened and swept back in a pompadour. "Brother Smalls, you just missed an excellent presentation," Reverend Reynolds said. "This young man, Brother Obama, has a plan to organize a meeting about the recent gang shooting." Reverend Smalls poured himself a cup of coffee and perused the flyer. "What's the name of your organization?" he asked me. "Developing Communities Project." "Developing Communities," his brow knotted. "I think I remember some white man coming around here talking about some developing something or other. Funny-looking guy. Jewish name. You connected to the Catholics?" I told him that some of the Catholic churches in the area were involved. "That's right, I remember now." Reverend Smalls sipped his coffee and leaned back in his chair. "I told that white man he might as well pack up and get on out of here. We don't need anything like this around here. Listen, what's your name again? Obama? Listen, Obama, you may mean well. I'm sure you do. But the last thing we need is to join up with a bunch of white money and Catholic churches and Jewish organizers to solve our problems. They're not interested in us. Shoot, the archdiocese in this city is run by stone-cold racists. Always has been. White folks coming in here think that they know what's best for us, hiring a bunch of high-talking, college-educated brothers like yourself who don't know no better, and all they want to do is take over. It's all a political thing, and that's not what this group here is about." I stammered that the church had always taken the lead in addressing community issues, but Reverend Smalls just shook his head. "You don't understand," he said. "Things have changed with the new mayor. I've known the district police commander since he was a beat cop. The aldermen in this area are all committed to black empowerment. Why we need to be protesting and carrying on at our own people? Anybody sitting around this table got a direct line to City Hall. Fred, didn't you just talk to the alderman about getting a permit for your parking lot?" The rest of the room had grown quiet. Reverend Small smiled and patted me on the shoulder. "Don't misunderstand me now. Like I said, I know you mean well. We need some young blood to help out with the cause. All I'm saying is that right now, you're on the wrong side of the battle." I sat there, roasting like a pig on a spit, as the pastors went on to discuss a joint Thanksgiving service in the park across the street. When the meeting was over, Reverend Reynolds and a few others thanked me for coming. "Don't take Charles too seriously," one of them advised. "He can be a little strong sometimes." But I noticed none of them left with my flyers. And later in the week, when I tried to call some of the ministers back, their secretaries kept telling me they were gone for the day. We went forward with our police meeting, which proved a small disaster. Only 13 people showed up, scattered across rows of empty chairs. The district commander canceled on us, sending a community relations officer instead. Every few minutes, an older couple walked in looking for the bingo game. I spent most of the evening directing this wayward traffic upstairs while Ruby sat glumly on stage, listening to the policeman lecture about the need for parental discipline. About halfway through the meeting, Marty arrived. After it was over, he came up and put a hand on my shoulder. "Feels like shit, huh?" It did. He helped me clean up, then took me out for coffee and pointed out some of my mistakes. "The problem of gangs was too general to make an impression on people," he said. "Issues had to be made concrete, specific, winnable. I should have prepared Ruby more carefully and set out fewer chairs. Most importantly, I needed to spend more time getting to know the leaders in the community. Flyers couldn't pull people out on a rainy night." "That reminds me," he said as we stood up. "Whatever happened to those pastors you were supposed to be meeting with?" I told him about Reverend Smalls. He started to laugh. "Guess it's a good thing I didn't tag along, huh?" I wasn't amused. "Why didn't you warn me about Smalls?" "I did warn you," Marty said, opening the door to his car. "I told you Chicago's polarized and the politicians use it to their own advantage. That's all Smalls is, a politician who happens to wear a collar. Anyway, it's not the end of the world. You should just be glad you learned your lesson early. Watching Marty drive away, I thought back to the day of the rally. The rows of black and white faces in the school auditorium, there because of the factory's desolation and Marty's own sense of betrayal. The cardinal, a small, pale, unassuming man in a black robe and glasses, smiling on stage as Will swallowed him up in a big bear hug. Will, so certain that the two men understood each other. Each image carried its own lesson. Each was subject to differing interpretations. For there were many churches, many faiths. There were times, perhaps, when those faiths seemed to converge. The crowd in front of the Lincoln Memorial, the Freedom Riders at the lunch counter. But such moments were partial, fragmentary. With our eyes closed, we uttered the same words, but in our hearts we each prayed to our own masters. We each remained locked in our own memories. A man like Reverend Smalls understood that people didn't want the victory of Harold's election, their victory, qualified. They wouldn't want to hear that their problems were more complicated than a group of devious white aldermen, or that their redemption was incomplete. Both Marty and Smalls knew that in politics, like religion, power lay in certainty, and that one man's certainty always threatened another's. I realized then, standing in an empty McDonald's parking lot in the south side of Chicago, that I was a heretic. Or worse, for even a heretic must believe in something, if nothing more than the truth of his own doubt. The Altgeld Gardens public housing project sat at Chicago's southernmost edge. 2,000 apartments, arranged in a series of two-story brick buildings, with army green doors and grimy mock shutters. To the east, on the other side of the expressway, was the Lake Calumet landfill, the largest in the Midwest. And to the north, directly across the street, was the Metropolitan Sanitary District's sewage treatment plant. The people of Altgeld couldn't see the plant or the open-air vats that went on for close to a mile. As part of a recent beautification effort, the district maintained a long wall of earth in front of the facility. But officials could do nothing to hide the smell, a heavy, putrid odor that varied in strength depending on the temperature and the wind's direction, and seeped through windows no matter how tightly they were shut. The stench, the toxins, the empty, uninhabited landscape. For close to a century, the few square miles surrounding Altgeld had taken on the offal of scores of factories, the price people had paid for their high-wage factory jobs. Now that the jobs were gone, and those people that could had already left, it seemed only natural to use the land as a dump. A dump and a place to house poor blacks. Altgeld may have been unique in its physical isolation, but it shared with the city's other projects a common history. The dreams of reformers to build decent housing for the poor, the politics that had concentrated such housing away from white neighborhoods and prevented working families from living there, the use of the Chicago Housing Authority, the CHA, as a patronage trough, the subsequent mismanagement and neglect. It wasn't as bad as Chicago's high-rise projects yet. The Robert Taylors and Cambrini Greens with their ink-black stairwells and urine-stained lobbies and random shootings. Altgeld's occupancy rate held steady at 90%, and if you went inside the apartments, you would more often than not find them well-kept, with small touches, a patterned cloth thrown over torn upholstery, an old calendar left hanging on the wall for its tropical beach scenes that expressed the lingering idea of home. Still, everything about the garden seemed in a perpetual state of disrepair. Ceilings crumbled, pipes burst, toilets backed up, muddy tire tracks branded the small brown lawns strewn with empty flower planters, broken, tilted, half-buried. The CHA maintenance crews had stopped even pretending that repairs would happen anytime soon, so that most children in Altgeld grew up without ever having seen a garden. Children who could see only that things were used up, and that there was a certain pleasure in speeding up the decay. I took a turn into Altgeld at 131st, and came to a stop in front of Our Lady of the Gardens Church, a flat brick building towards the rear of the development. I was there to meet some of our key leaders, to talk about the problems of our organizing effort, and how we might get things back on track. Over 2 months had passed since the botched police meeting, and things had gone badly. There had been no marches, no sit-ins, no freedom songs, just a series of miscues and misunderstandings, tedium and stress. Part of the problem was our base, which, in the city at least, had never been large. 8 Catholic parishes flung across several neighborhoods, all with black congregations, but all led by white priests. "The truth is," one of the priests told me, "most of us are out here looking to get a transfer. The only reason I'm still around is that nobody's willing to replace me." Morale was even worse among the laity, black folks like Angela, Shirley, and Mona, the three women I'd met at the rally. They were spirited, good-humored women, those three. Women who, without husbands to help, somehow managed to raise sons and daughters, juggle an assortment of part-time jobs and small business schemes, and organize Girl Scout troops, fashion shows, and summer camps for the parade of children that wandered through the church every day. Since none of the three actually lived in Ortgeld, they all owned small houses just west of the project, I'd asked them once what motivated them to do what they did. Before I could finish the question, they'd all rolled their eyes as if on cue. "Watch out, girl," Angela told Shirley, causing Mona to chuckle merrily. "Barack's about to interview you. He's got that look." And Shirley said, "We're just a bunch of bored, middle-aged women, Barack, with nothing better to do with our time. But," and here Shirley threw a hand on her bony hip and raised her cigarette to her lips like a movie star, "if Mr. Wright comes along, then watch out. It's goodbye, Ortgeld. Hello, Monte Carlo." I hadn't heard any jokes from them lately, though. All I'd heard were complaints. The women complained that Marty didn't care about Ortgeld. They complained that Marty was arrogant and didn't listen to their suggestions. Most of all, they complained about the new job bank that we had announced with such fanfare the night of the rally, but that had turned out to be a bust. As Marty had planned it, a state university out in the suburbs had been assigned to run the program. It was a matter of efficiency, he explained, since the university had the computers already in place. Unfortunately, 2 months after it was supposed to have started, no one had found work through the program. The computers didn't work right. The data entry was plagued with errors. People were sent to interviews for jobs that didn't exist. Marty was livid, and at least once a week he would have to drive out to the university, cursing under his breath as he tried to pry answers out of officials who seemed more concerned with next year's funding cycle. But the women from Ortgeld weren't interested in Marty's frustrations. All they knew was that $500,000 had gone somewhere, and it wasn't in their neighborhood. For them, the job bank became yet more evidence that Marty had used them to push a secret agenda, that somehow whites in the suburbs were getting the jobs they'd been promised. "Marty's just looking out for his own," they grumbled. I tried my best to mediate the conflict, defending Marty against charges of racism, suggesting to him that he cultivate more tact. Marty told me I was wasting my time. According to him, the only reason Angela and the other leaders in the city were sore was because he'd refused to hire them to run the program. That's what ruins a lot of so-called community organizations out here. They start taking government money, they hire big do-nothing staffs, pretty soon they become big patronage operations with clients to be serviced. Not leaders, clients to be serviced. He spit out the words as if they were unclean. Jesus, it makes you sick just thinking about it. Winter came, and the city turned monochrome. Black trees against gray sky, above white earth. Night now fell in mid-afternoon, especially when the snowstorms rolled in, boundless prairie storms that set the sky close to the ground, the city lights reflected against the clouds. The work was tougher in such weather. Mounds of fine white powder blew through the cracks of my car, down my collar and into the openings of my coat. On rounds of interviews, I never spent enough time in one place to thaw properly, and parking spaces became scarce on the snow-narrowed streets. Everyone, it seemed, had a cautionary tale about fights breaking out over parking spaces after a heavy snow, the resulting brawl or shooting. Attendance at evening meetings became more sporadic. People called at the last minute to say they had the flu or their car wouldn't start. Those who did come looked damp and resentful. At times, driving home from such evenings, with the northern gusts off the lake shaking my car across the lane dividers, I would momentarily forget where I was, my thoughts a numbed reflection of the silence. Marty suggested that I take more time off, build a life for myself away from the job. His concerns were professionally explained. Without some personal support outside the work, an organizer lost perspective and could quickly burn out. There was something to what he said, for it was true that the people I met on the job were generally much older than I was, with a set of concerns and demands that created barriers to friendship. When I wasn't working, the weekends would usually find me alone in an empty apartment, making do with the company of books. I didn't heed Marty's advice, though, perhaps because, as the bonds between myself and the leadership grew stronger, I found them offering more than simple friendship. After meetings, I might go with one of the men to a local tavern, to watch the news or listen to oldies, the Temptations, the OJs, thump from a dinged-up corner jukebox. On Sunday, I'd visit a church service and let the women tease me over my confusion with communion and prayer. At a Christmas party, I danced with women old enough to be my mother. I talk sports over stale cheese puffs and meatballs with husbands who had been reluctantly dragged to the affair. I counseled sons or daughters on their college applications and played with grandchildren who sat on my knee. It was during such times, when familiarity or wariness dissolved the lines between organizer and those I was supposed to be organizing, that I learned the most about the work I had chosen. I learned that the self-interest I was supposed to be looking for extended well beyond the immediacy of issues, that beneath the small talk and sketchy biographies and received opinions, people carried within them some central explanation of themselves, stories full of terror and wonder, studded with events that still haunted or inspired them. Sacred stories. Not to say that everything I learned from the leaders cheered my heart. If they often revealed a strength of spirit I hadn't imagined, they also forced me to acknowledge the unspoken forces that retarded our efforts, secrets that we kept from each other as well as from ourselves. That's how it was with Ruby, for example. After our aborted meeting with the police commander, I had worried that she might back away from organizing. Instead, she had thrown herself headlong into the project, working hard to build a network of neighbors that could be regularly delivered to our events, coming up with ideas for registering voters, or working with school parents. She was what every organizer dreamed about, someone with untapped talent, smart, steady, excited by the idea of a public life, eager to learn. And I liked her son, Kyle Jr. He had just turned 14, and in all of his awkwardness, one moment frisky and bumping into me while we shot baskets together in the neighborhood park, the next instant bored and sullen, I could see all the contours of my own youthful struggles. Sometimes Ruby would question me about him, exasperated with a mediocre report card or a cut on his chin, baffled by a young man's unruly mind. "Last week he said he was going to be a rap artist," she would report. "Today he tells me he's going into the Air Force Academy to be a fighter pilot. When I asked him why, he just says, 'So I can fly,' like I was stupid. I swear, Barack, sometimes I don't know whether to hug him or beat his skinny behind." "Try both," I would tell her. One day, just before Christmas, I asked Ruby to stop by my office so I could give her a present for Kyle. I was on the phone when she walked in, and out of the corner of my eye I thought I saw something different about her, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was. Only after I had hung up and she turned toward me did I realize that her eyes, normally a warm, dark brown that matched the color of her skin, had turned an opaque shade of blue, as if someone had glued plastic buttons over her irises. She asked me if something was wrong. "What'd you do to your eyes?" "Oh, these." Ruby shook her head and laughed. "They're just contacts, Barack. The company I work for makes cosmetic lenses, and I get them at a discount. Do you like them?" "Your eyes look just fine the way they were." "It's just for fun," she said, looking down. "Something different, you know?" I stood there not knowing what to say. Finally, I remembered Kyle's gift and handed it to Ruby. "For Kyle," I said. "A book on airplanes. I thought he might like it." Ruby nodded and put the book inside her purse. "That's nice of you, Barack. I'm sure he will." Then, abruptly, she stood up and straightened her skirt. "Well, I better be going," she said, and hurried out the door. For the rest of the day and into the next, I thought about Ruby's eyes. I'd handled the moment badly, I told myself, made her feel ashamed for a small vanity in a life that could afford few vanities. I realized that a part of me expected her and the other leaders to possess some sort of immunity from the onslaught of images that feed every American's insecurities. The slender models in the fashion magazines, the square-jawed men in fast cars, images to which I myself was vulnerable and from which I had sought protection. When I mentioned the incident to a black woman friend of mine, she stated the issue more bluntly. "What are you surprised about?" my friend said impatiently. "That black people still hate themselves?" "No," I told her, "it wasn't exactly surprise that I was feeling. Since my first frightening discovery of bleaching creams in Life magazine, I'd become familiar with the lexicon of color consciousness within the black community. Good hair, bad hair, thick lips or thin, if you're light, you're all right, if you're black, get back. In college, the politics of black fashion and the questions of self-esteem that fashion signified had been a frequent, if delicate, topic of conversation for black students, especially among the women, who would smile bitterly at the sight of the militant brother who always seemed to be dating light-skinned girls, and tongue-lash any black man who was foolish enough to make a remark about a black woman's hairstyle. Mostly, I had kept quiet when these subjects were broached, privately measuring my own degree of infection. But I noticed that such conversations rarely took place in large groups, and never in front of whites. Later, I would realize that the position of most black students in predominantly white colleges was already too tenuous, our identities too scrambled, to admit to ourselves that our black pride remained incomplete. And to admit our doubt and confusion to whites, to open up our psyches to general examination by those who had caused so much of the damage in the first place, seemed ludicrous, itself an expression of self-hatred. For there seemed no reason to expect that whites would look at our private struggles as a mirror into their own souls, rather than yet more evidence of black pathology. It was in observing that division, I think, between what we talked about privately and what we addressed publicly, that I'd learned not to put too much stock in those who trumpeted black self-esteem as a cure for all our ills, whether substance abuse or teen pregnancy or black-on-black crime. By the time I reached Chicago, the phrase self-esteem seemed to be on everyone's lips, activists, talk show hosts, educators, and sociologists. It was a handy catch-all to describe our hurt, a sanitized way of talking about the things we'd been keeping to ourselves. But whenever I tried to pin down this idea of self-esteem, the specific qualities we hoped to inculcate, the specific means by which we might feel good about ourselves, the conversation always seemed to follow a path of infinite regress. Did you dislike yourself because of your color, or because you couldn't read and couldn't get a job? Or perhaps it was because you were unloved as a child. Only, were you unloved because you were too dark, or too light, or because your mother shot heroin into her veins? And why did she do that anyway? Was the sense of emptiness you felt a consequence of your kinky hair, or the fact that your apartment had no heat and no decent furniture? Or was it because deep down you imagined a godless universe? Maybe one could not avoid such questions on the road to personal salvation. What I doubted was that all the talk about self-esteem could serve as the centerpiece for an effective black politics. It demanded too much honest self-reckoning from people. Without such honesty, it easily degenerated into vague exhortation. Perhaps with more self-esteem, fewer blacks would be poor, I thought to myself, but I had no doubt that poverty did nothing for our self-esteem. Better to concentrate on the things we might all agree on. Give that black man some tangible skills and a job. Teach that black child reading and arithmetic in a safe, well-funded school. With the basics taken care of, each of us could search for our own sense of self-worth. Ruby shook up this predisposition of mine, the wall I had erected between psychology and politics, the state of our pocketbooks, and the state of our souls. In fact, that particular episode was only the most dramatic example of what I was hearing and seeing every day. It expressed itself when a black leader casually explained to me that he never dealt with black contractors. A black man will just mess it up, and I'll end up paying white folks to do it all over again. Or in another leader's rationale for why she couldn't mobilize other people in her church. Black folks are just lazy, Barack. Don't want to do nothing. Often the word nigger replaced black in such remarks. A word I had once liked to think was spoken in jest, with a knowing irony, the inside joke that marked our resilience as a people. Until the first time I heard a young mother use it on her child to tell him he wasn't worth shit, or watching teenage boys use it to draw blood in a quick round of verbal sparring. The transformation of the word's original meaning was never complete. Like the other defenses we erected against possible hurt, this one too involves striking out at ourselves first. If the language, the humor, the stories of ordinary people were the stuff out of which families, communities, economics would have to be built, then I couldn't separate that strength from the hurt and distortion that lingered inside us. And it was the implication of that fact, I realized, that had most disturbed me when I had looked into Ruby's eyes. The stories that I'd been hearing from the leadership, all the records of courage and sacrifice and overcoming of great odds, hadn't simply arisen from struggles with pestilence or drought, or even mere poverty. They had arisen out of a very particular experience with hate. That hate hadn't gone away. It formed a counter-narrative, buried deep within each person, and at the center of which stood white people, some cruel, some ignorant, sometimes a single face, sometimes just a faceless image of a system claiming power over our lives. I had to ask myself whether the bonds of community could be restored without collectively exorcising that ghostly figure that haunted black dreams. Could Ruby love herself without hating blue eyes?